Okay, great. So, thank you very much for inviting me to tell you a little bit about our recent work on Weil and Dirac semi-metals in high magnetic fields. I'm James Analidis. I'm from the University of California, Berkeley. But before I begin, I really want to tell you about the people that did all of the hard work in this talk. Specifically, it was a collaboration between my group, my student Nitya Nair, for example, and postdoc Philip Moll, and Ashwin Viswanath's group. And I just want to point out two very important people. Philip Moll, who's now going to be a group leader at Max Planck in Dresden, and he really drove a lot of the physics that I'm going to present today. He's going to be a force of nature, so remember his name. Keep an eye out for him. And then the second important person is Andrew Potter, who we have collaborated with very closely to understand the theory behind these materials, both in terms of his work has both inspired some of the experiments that we've done, but also has explained some of the experiments that we couldn't fully understand. So the synergy between these two has been really great, and I also want to point out that both of them are funded by the Gordon and Betty Moore Foundation, without whose support we wouldn't have actually been able to do any of this work. Okay, so I'm going to tell you a little bit about the physics of these materials, or the properties of these materials in high magnetic fields, and my talk is more or less divided up into three parts. I'll give you an introduction into the types of properties that we're actually interested in measuring, and in the next two parts, I'll tell you about two important experiments. One of them measuring the surface states of these materials, and the second one is what I believe going to be a new probe in terms of experimentally identifying new kinds of topological materials. So I'm very excited to get to that. Now, I know Drew Potter has already given a very nice talk about the theory and some of the experiment behind these materials, so I actually won't focus too much on the introduction. And I'll try and be brief about part two, even though there's a lot of detail to go through there. In fact, my talk borrows very heavily from his, especially in the introductory part. The kinds of plots that you'll be seeing throughout are these kinds. We'll measure. Sorry. Oh, right. So we measure properties, whether it's transport or magnetization, as a function of magnetic field, and you'll see oscillations in that magnetic field, which are associated with Landau quantization. I'll get to that in a minute. And it's the analysis of this kind of data that is basically the basis of all of our conclusions. So you'll get to see quite a bit of that. So let me take you to part one. The introduction to the physics of these materials, and there are two or several seminal papers that are the basis of this work. It's particularly one by Ashwin Viswanath and Savrasov that gave the first theory behind Fermi arcs on pyroclore systems as possible time reversal symmetry breaking Weil semi-metals. And then there are, of course, other follow-up works that have made their own seminal contributions, particularly Drew's work, which will be the inspiration for the first experiment. Okay. So when discussing topological properties of materials, I think it's very useful to go to Michael Berry's seminal paper in the 1980s, where he discussed the physics of closed quasiparticle orbits in some space. And one of the important points of this paper is that degeneracies in the spectrum actually play a very important role in the kind of geometric phase you get in these systems. Specifically, when you take a closed orbit and integrate over the full space, what a degeneracy looks like is very much like Dirac's magnetic monopole. So it turns out that when you take this integral, the surface integral, where B is now known, it plays the role of an effective Berry magnetic field or Berry curvature, over the parameter space, the surface area of the parameter space that you're interested in, this integral turns out to be quantized in what's become known as the Chern number, or negative of the Chern number in this case, the way I've plotted it here. So degeneracies play a very important role, and they effectively look like Dirac's magnetic monopole. So it's quite a useful way to look and understand how the physics of Weil systems. So when you look at the Weil Hamiltonian, the important point is that momentum K and spin sigma are intrinsically coupled together in a Hamiltonian. So a Weil node starts to look like an effective magnetic monopole, but that monopole is now in K-space and Fourier space. And so it inherits a lot of the topological properties that we associated with Berry's geometric phase. No, so what I plotted here is, of course, the energy spectrum in k-space, and you end up, this is the Dirac node, or the Weil node. And it is this where that becomes very important in the context of understanding the geometric properties of quasi-particles making orbits in these systems. Now, it turns out that as a consequence of this Hamiltonian, chirality becomes a good quantum number in these systems. And just from some simple symmetry arguments, you can see that a Weil node must always come in pairs with opposite Berry flux. In particular, there must be two magnetic monopoles, one with flux coming out and one with flux going in. And each of these, or the quasi-particles associated with each of these nodes, has the opposite sign of a chiral quantum number. So this becomes important because once chirality is a good quantum number in these systems, we have to ask the question, how do we connect different quasi-particles with different chiralities? And that results in all sorts of interesting properties. So when there are two important ways that have been discussed in the literature of how to connect chirality. And the first one, which I won't go into detail because it's not really the focus of this work, is what's known as the chiral anomaly. And the basic idea is that when you put the magnetic field on these materials, I'll get to the details of how this happens later on in the talk, and you quantize the energy spectrum, the lowest Landau level still preserves a good chiral quantum number. But now if you apply an electric field and a magnetic field parallel to each other, you can actually connect particles from one Weil node to the other Weil node, and in that sense transfer chirality. Now the other way to do it is, of course, since by breaking some of the symmetries in the system itself. So for example, if you think of a material, here I've combined both real space and k-space in this diagram, but at the interface of the material you've broken the translational symmetry of the system. And in that case, chirality stops being a good quantum number, so now you're able to connect these two Weil nodes via a surface state. And that surface state is what Ashvin and Savrazov theorized would manifest itself as a Fermi arc connecting these two. And this is a picture in k-space, but this is the k-space picture of the surface state. Okay. Importantly, it's not a closed Fermi surface. It's just an arc in k-space. So this was quite an unusual, and it caused quite a buzz. And the next question was, of course, how would you measure such an object? Okay, so that's all Drew's stuff. There's a couple of things that I want to point out. There are essentially three categories of the kinds of systems that we're talking about. In order to have a pure Weil system, or in other words, one with an odd number of Weil pairs of a positive and negative chirality, you actually have to have your system break time reversal symmetry, which is why the first systems that were discussed in this context were actually magnetic systems, pyroclores. If you want to have your Weil pairs separated, but don't want to break time reversal symmetry, the only way you can do that is to break, for example, inversion symmetry. So there's a number of new systems where the Weil pairs are in separate parts of k-space, but they always come in an even number of pairs. So tantalum arsenide, which we'll be discussing a relative of this in the latter part of the talk. And then finally, if you neither want to break time reversal symmetry or inversion symmetry, but you still want to have a Weil system, well, then you've got a problem. Because your Weil pairs still have to come in even numbers, but now if they're in even numbers, they have to be on top of each other and interact. And if they interact, they'll gap out the Weil node, and this is a big problem. So in order to prevent the system from gapping itself out of the Weil node, you need to have additional symmetries. And usually these are rotational symmetries like C4 or C6, C4 in the case of cadmium arsenide, I think it's C3 or C6 in the case of sodium bismuth. And once you have those additional symmetries, you can actually still have an effective Weil system, but you have two copies of the Weil node in a single part of k-space with both chiralities.
And if you have both T and inversion broken, then what?
Oh, that's a good question. I assume you can still have this. So you can still have an odd number of Weil pairs. But yes, it's a good question whether there's something funny that happens once you have TP symmetry broken, whether the two signs can't. Yeah, I'm not sure. Yeah. Someone in here will definitely know the answer to this.
Chemical potential will be. But the Weil nodes will not add the same energy.
Right, you can still have. Right, okay, that's a good point. The Weil nodes won't be at the same energy, but. Okay. All right. Well, yeah, it's not by symmetry, they don't have to be at the same energy, and therefore they in general won't be. Okay, so there's a number of experimental observations of these kinds of states, and this is why in the last year or two this field has been booming and being very exciting. Now, I've got four different probes that I've identified here as important works. Almost all of the pictures that I'm showing you here are from the Princeton group. So a lot of people like Zahid Hassan, Ali Yazdani, and Fuan Ong, Bob Carver, who's provided them with all their materials, have really driven this field forward. What you're looking at here on the left is angle-resolved photoemission data. So this is, in principle, a direct probe in K-space of the Fermi surface. And these arcs here are thought to be the manifestation of the Fermi arc at the surfaces of this material that breaks inversion symmetry. Ali Yazdani is, of course, focused on STM. He's made some beautiful progress on materials like cadmium arsenide, for example. And then Fuan Ong has been focusing on the transport properties of these materials, and he has a very interesting paper that was recently published in Science, where he observes negative magnetoresistance, and this is thought to be associated with the chiral anomaly that I mentioned in brief a couple of slides ago. And it's strongly angle dependent, which is thought to be evidence of the E dot B property. There's a fourth work that I've got on the slide that I don't think is published yet, but I think it's very interesting. It's on the archive. It's by the Xu group in Fudan, where they measured non-local transport in one of these systems. And what they see is that you get a very strong but purely negative magnetoresistance effect the further away you go from the applied electric field. And this is thought to be a manifestation of pure chiral anomaly physics, which should be non-local. So that was an interesting and exciting paper as well. But in general, and this is important, the take-home point from this slide for understanding what evidence really exists for these materials, almost all of it is dominated by angle-resolved photoemission. All of these other probes, in general, might have other interpretations, but photoemission has been the primary go-to probe for the community to know whether there are interesting surface states on these materials. I think most people will agree with that uncontroversially. Yeah.
Which material was this again? The non-local.
This guy. This was cadmium arsenide, and they did it on nano ribbons.
Okay.
Yeah. Sorry, I didn't write it there. Yeah. I can give you the reference after the talk if you want. Okay. So, enter part two. I think I'm in good time. So here we'll be focusing on quantum oscillations from what I will call while orbits, will be cyclotron orbits associated with these Fermi arcs. And the material that I'll be talking about is not while, but one of these 3D Dirac systems, cadmium arsenide, which has the while degeneracy protected by symmetry of the system itself. Okay, you can find our work on the archive. Before I tell you about the specifics of this experiment, let me just give you a brief introduction to why you get Landau quantization. When you have a quasi-part, this is a Fermi surface in K-space for some general quasi-two-dimensional Fermi surface. When you apply a magnetic field, you allow the particles to orbit, and it's this orbital motion that quantizes the energy spectrum as to what's known as Landau levels. That quantization leads, as a function of, that changes as a function of field, leads to oscillations in all properties of the material, whether that be the heat capacity or the magnetization or the transport. In the case of the bulk of these Dirac systems, you would get, in general, your band structure would be quantized in the following way in K-space. Importantly, actually, for all Dirac systems, your lowest Landau level always stays pinned to the E equals zero energy. We'll get back to that to the latter part of the talk. But okay, so the point is you want to have some closed quasi-particle orbit, enter all this Berry phase physics, of course, and you want to know how can you have these kinds of orbits but associated with the Fermi arcs. And in addition to that, they're always this quantization has to be at the surface of the material. Now, quantum oscillatory phenomena has been very useful to identify surface states in other systems. I cite here a work by Lu Li from Michigan, where he looked at quantum oscillations from surface states of samarium hexaboride. And what's really neat about this work is that he can look at the quantum oscillations, then take their angle dependence, and of course, because they're surface states, they should be quite completely two-dimensional, and he can identify surface states from different facets of the crystal itself, which is quite neat. Okay, so
this is material considered topological condom insulator?
That's right. This material is considered a topological condom insulator. So,
Is it indeed a topological Cantor insulator? Is this a proof?
Well, I don't want to comment on that debate. The point is, he definitely sees surface states, and they're definitely from samarium hexaboride. Well, at least, I think they're almost definitely. There isn't even debate about that. But this is pretty convincing, I thought. The fact that you see quasi-two-dimensional surfaces as a function of rotating the system, and they correspond exactly to the direction of these facets, is pretty convincing to me. Whether they're topological or not, I guess that's another debate.
So this surface state cannot prove it's a topological origin?
I don't think you can conclusively say, just by measuring quantum oscillations that are two-dimensional, that a surface state is topological. I think that's fair to say. You can measure the phase of the oscillations and say, oh, look, I've got this Berry phase offset, but you know, I've played this game, it's complicated. Yeah. But what I'm trying to say is that other materials have surface states. But I don't really want to comment any further. It's a beautiful work. It's very convincing. He definitely sees surface states. Very likely they could be associated with the topological surface states of a Kondo insulator.
So there's no way to distinguish is due to topological rhythm or just due to trivial rhythm is a surface state?
My opinion is that purely from quantum oscillations, it's very difficult to make that. To make that distinction. That's right. So a combination of photo emission and other probes. But this relates to the second half of my talk. I do think there's a way to litmus test whether a material is topological or not. I'll get to that in a second. Although it's still difficult with surface states. Okay. So let's go. This is again a reproduction from Drew's talk. So you've probably seen this before. What we want to do is make a closed orbit with Fermi arc states. So think of applying a magnetic field onto the Fermi arc state, one that connects one Weyl node to the other of opposite chiralities, and of course it's going to go from one to the other. But then the question is, what is it going to do once it gets here? Charge just can't accumulate indefinitely. The important point to note is that the surface states by energy are connected to the bulk states, which are also quantized by a magnetic field. So since they do have available states in the bulk, you can imagine that the quasi-particle at the surface is going to be able to go into the bulk, and then it's in a bulk Landau level. So now there are gaps between all other states in the bulk, right? So now it's going to follow a single Landau level state, and it's actually going to follow a Lorentz force free path. And because of the nature of this force, it's going to be pushed to the other side, and then it's going to find the other surface. Again, it's going to continuously connected, go across that the Fermi arc on the other side, and then back through, and voila, you've got a closed quasi-particle orbit. This is effectively the cyclotron orbit of the Fermi arc states, but the curious part, and this is the important take-home point from this slide, is that it involves two paths, one in K-space and one in real space, and each of them have their own time scale. The one in K-space is just associated with the Fermi velocity and Fermi momentum at the surface state, and the one in real space is just simply related to the length, the thickness of the sample, and the velocity that it's actually traversing that sample. So this is very important because it's unlike any other quasi-particle orbit that we think of in Landau quasi states, whether they're bulk or surface, because it has characters of both.
Do we need to worry about scattering events or not?
Well, let's not get to that right now. You do have to worry about the scattering. I will get to that in a second. But here's the point. You do need a coherent orbit to be closed in order to get the Landau quantization. Same as you would need a closed cyclotron orbit to get the Landau quantization. But the really important point here is that you don't want it to scatter while it's in the bulk, right? So you want the transport to be coherent from one surface to the other. The simple way of saying that is that the thickness of the sample has to be of the order of the mean free path of the sample. Okay?
So you, in this picture, you mix the K, surface K, momentum space, Bach is real space. So this is completely semi-classical.
This is a semi-classical picture of it, yeah.
So you can mix K space and then real space.
That's right, but those exist in different parts of the sample. So it's the K space of the surface and the real space of the bulk. And in the bulk, the spectrum is quantized because of Landau quantization. So there's a gap between one Landau level, the Landau level that it goes into, and all of the other Landau levels. So it stays in just one.
So in the bulk, it's quantization, it's quantum physics.
It's still quantized in the bulk. Yeah.
The surface is semi-classical.
No, this is a semi-classical picture. It's still quantum, of course. But the point is you're making a closed orbit, and this quantizes the spectrum of the surface states in a similar way that we think of the orbital motion in K-space quantizes the energy levels of bulk. So all you need for this quantization, adiabatic continuity, you know, all of that kind of thing, is just the closed orbit. Yeah?
So in real material, if the Fermi energy slightly deviates from exactly at the wild node, is there some consequence for the part in the bulk?
Yes, there is. Yeah. So I'll get to that in a second as well. So this is still a picture of what the Landau levels, what quantize in the bulk. The fact that you have bulk and surface nature, the quantization of the surface state becomes very unusual. Okay? And I'll get to that in a second, because it involves the thickness of the bulk. Before I get to that, let me just tell you what the surface looks like, and this answers your question. So the few remarks about this, the wild orbit itself involves both real space and K-space, I've already said that. The real space trajectory doesn't actually enclose any flux. It goes directly from one node to the other, because chirality is a good quantum number in the bulk, so it preserves that number as it goes from one surface to the other. But the K-space trajectory actually does enclose a flux. So when you turn the sample on its side and have a look at the K-space orbit, it still encloses an area, AK, which will be proportional to the frequency that you actually see in your quantum oscillatory behavior. So it's this projection that actually is associated with the frequency of the oscillatory phenomena. Okay. Right. So it will look like a bit like a surface state with this kind of frequency. Okay. This is the part about quantization of the bulk Landau levels that I think is really important. So normally, you don't, in terms of thinking what your energy levels, your Landau levels are actually going to look like, you don't have to worry about the thickness of the sample, you just have to worry about what the K-space trajectory actually looks like. And that would determine what the energy spacing would be between your Landau levels. But here, your quasi-particle orbit also involves the time scale of traversing the bulk. And as a consequence, you actually have some very unusual behavior in your quantum oscillatory phenomena. First one is that the position of your Landau levels and magnetic field actually changes depending on the thickness of the sample. Why is this important? Because it means that the phase of your oscillations is actually thickness dependent. So you can change the phase continuously depending on the thickness of the sample. Number two, and this takes a little bit of explaining, because the thickness doesn't vary with magnetic field, presumably, you actually end up in the high field regime crossing a point where you actually don't see any quantum oscillatory phenomena at all, because now your Landau levels saturate to this level. So you can think of this time scale becoming a high field, becoming very small compared to this time scale. So now your energy quantization is entirely determined by what the thickness of the bulk is, right? And the velocity, of course, that it's actually traveling in. So at a certain field, you actually stop seeing quantum oscillations, and this is what Drew discussed as the saturation field. Just to also answer your question about what happens when you've got some finite filling, it would change the effective area of your projected quasi-particle orbit. Instead of being one that connects just the nodes, it would connect the edges of the, this is the projection in K-space, this would be the filled state of the Fermi, of the Dirac dispersion, and you would just connect one side of the dispersion to the other. So it would effectively increase the area of your quasi-particle orbit projected in K-space. Okay, so basically you look for these kinds of two signatures. This is very important to remember, that the phase depends on length, and you also see the saturation field.
This figure, so when the wire node gets bigger because of chemical potential, so the Fermi arc also gets very steep, right? The Fermi arc gets weak. Is that what you showed here?
The Fermi arc gets wider, yeah.
Get some width.
Width, yeah, that's right.
Proportional to the chemical potential.
The chemical potential of the bulk, that's right. That's the basic idea, yeah. So you can change your surface state area by changing the chemical potential of the bulk. the thing is, it's actually a very small effect because the chemical potential of these materials is already very low. They're semi-metals.
It's important for your picture that the Fermi arcs are curves because in some models
it is
a straight line that connects the tubes.
Yeah.
It's actually important.
That's well pointed out. So the point is, if these were just lines, you wouldn't enclose any area. So you'd get no surface area if your chemical potential was in at the wild node, right? But if it was away from the wild node, you would still get some area enclosed. But that's a very good point. We can't distinguish between whether it's curved or slightly flat or whatever.
Okay, but if it was straight, there would be no...
And your chemical potential is at the wild node, then you would have no area enclosed. That's right. But, okay, the shape of these curves really depends on surface effects, like what the dangling bonds are and those kinds of things. So there's almost certainly going to be some dispersion. It's very unusual for it to be completely flat. Okay, so I have half an hour to get to through the experimental parts, so let me just step you through it. I make materials in my own lab as well as measure them. And the materials, in this particular case, it was my student Nitin Nair who actually made the system.
Oh, sorry, can I ask what happens if the field is not exactly lined along the z-axis, if there's some angle?
Great. I'm about to get to that as well, actually, because we do. But the short answer is, it looks very similar. The quantum oscillation frequency still depends on the perpendicular component of the field.
So the in-plane part doesn't matter for anything?
That's right, because the bulk still follows the bulk path. Still follows the exact parallel to the field, so it still doesn't enclose any flux. See what I mean?
Yeah. It has to drift along the field.
Exactly. Yeah. It has to drift parallel to the field. So the bulk still never encloses still flux, but the flux still varies on the surface state with the according to the perpendicular component.
Okay. I have a related question. So what happens if you have a material which has anisotropic tensor, basically, and has off diagonal parts, symmetric off diagonal parts?
So if it's monoclinic, for example, and so you had...
Yeah, you know, when you take sugar, you measure, you know, sigma...
Yeah, sure. Mm-hmm. I don't know the answer to that. Well, maybe... Okay, so you need low symmetry and still have a wild system. And, I mean, the bulk is still... So you're basically asking me, how does the bulk path depend on sigma bulk? I need to get back to you on that. I actually don't know. That's a good question. If you come up with a material with low symmetry, I'd be happy to measure it and tell you the answer that way. Okay, so this is what the crystals look like. They don't look very fancy, but actually to me, they're quite pretty. These are the facets, so you can tell crystallographic directions quite nicely. But they're big, really big, millimeters in size. So there's no way you're going to see in these effects because they're so dependent on the thickness. And as I mentioned earlier, you actually need to have the thickness of the sample of the order of the mean free path of the bulk. So we applied a trick, and this is where Philip Moll came in very useful. Philip spent his PhD working on a technique to measure correlated electron systems using a focused ion beam. A focused ion beam is a very expensive piece of machinery that accelerates, generally, in this case, gallium ions at your sample, and it heats up a very local area and blows off parts of your sample, okay? And so you can, by doing that, you can actually machine your sample to any shape that you want. In addition to that, it has an extra ability where it can actually also deposit metal on the sample as well. So you can use it in another function and accelerate, it's actually platinum covered in an organic molecule, and it can accelerate these towards the sample, and because of the heat, it blows off the organic part, just depositing the platinum directly on your material. And the reason why that's useful is because now you can contact your sample and measure the transport. So using this technique, we were able to turn this crystal into a device that looks like this. Let me just step you through what this what's actually going on here. These motley parts, which I haven't color-coded, are actually the contacts, the platinum contacts. Actually, in this case, I think we used gold, but it doesn't matter. These parts here, these black parts, are the components of the sample that we've machined out using this technique. So you can imagine that this whole thing was a part of this facet, and now we've blown out all of this and made this device. So now what we're able to do is from a single crystal, a single facet that did cover more than this slide, we were able to make three devices next to each other, all from the same sample, with three different thicknesses. And I think that's very clear. This particular one was going from 3 microns to 1 micron to 0.5 micron, something of that order. And now we pass current along here, and we measure the transport along the three different directions. So now we can measure the transport along three different thicknesses and really do this experiment to see if there's an onset of a new quantum oscillation frequency as a function of the thickness of the sample. As the thickness crosses a length scale that's much larger than the mean free path of the bulk to one that's smaller.
Is there much damage caused in the bulk?
That's a great question. There's an enormous amount of damage in general caused in the bulk. I don't know if it's clear here, but can you see this motley part of the sample? That's because the vapor pressure of arsenic is so different from cadmium. So it blows off all the arsenic and just leaves this weird pattern of cadmium on the surface. But here's the trick that we did. We machined the sample at grazing incidence. So the consequence is that you don't have the same kind of penetration depth of the gallium into the sample itself. And you can blow off parts of the sample in a very uniform and controlled way, so you can get nice flat surfaces. They're not atomic, well, they're close to very flat. And I'm not saying that the damage is zero, because you still need to heat up the sample to melt it. But it's minimal compared to, or as little as possible compared to what you see here. And to confess, when we came up with this idea to do this, we really didn't think it was going to work for exactly that reason. But the data speaks for itself. So here's a false color plot of the same kind of device. And here's what was really impressive with what Philip was able to do. Here we now go to very, very thin devices, down to 150 nanometers. He can even get to about 50 nanometers these days, which is really close to the thin film limit. You can see that this is thin because, see how this is slightly brighter than here? Very slightly. Okay, so this image is made with an electron beam. And the reason why it's slightly brighter is because this sample is so thin, it's now transparent to the electron beam. So it's been very important to be able to use this to get to really thin devices and get to the thin film limit from a single crystal without having to suffer to make a thin film chamber make the same kinds of samples. Okay, so here's an example plot of the kind of quantum oscillation data that we saw. We can apply the magnetic field in two directions, perpendicular to the field, which is the direction that you expect to see the surface quantum oscillations, and parallel to the field, which you would only see the bulk quantum oscillations. And they are the directions that I'm showing you here. So in 0 degrees, the field is perpendicular to the face. So that's the side that you actually expect to see the surface state oscillation. When you rotate the field in plane, then you only have the bulk state oscillations. And this is what the Fourier transform of that quantum oscillation data actually looks like. The blue, let's focus on that for now. That's, again, just supposed to show the bulk quantum oscillation. You see a very big peak at around 36 Tesla. This is known to be associated with the bulk physics. You can do the angle dependence. It's a completely three-dimensional. I'll show you in a second. And then when you rotate the field into the interplane direction, you get the bulk state again, which is expected. But now you see this huge peak at a frequency that you did not expect that is now associated let's just say for now that it's new and we didn't know what the origin was. So we did the usual thing. Oh, I should point this out. Okay, so let me guess that it's the surface state. If it was the surface state, then I can use Arpes data on the same compound to estimate the size of K0 and to estimate the approximate size of the Fermi surface that we'd actually see. Well, the frequency that we see, 60 Tesla, is approximately corresponding to this K0, the distance between the Weyl nodes, and that's about what photoemission has seen. So we thought this was an awfully good coincidence, if it's not the Weyl orbit. So now we can do the angle dependence, and again, the blue state is the bulk orbit. This is a polar plot of rotating this angle. Psychologically, it really shows exactly what's going on. So the bulk state is almost completely isotropic as a function of angle, which you expect and is known. But then when you look at our 60 Tesla frequency, it's completely flat as a function of angle, which is another way of saying that it only depends on the perpendicular component of the field, another way of saying that it's two-dimensional, completely two-dimensional.
How does the penetration depth of the 60 compare? In other words, could there be hybridization between?
Oh, I think there is, and There is, and let me get to that in a second, because I think we see it in the phase of the oscillations. But to first order, that's exactly what you would expect. And it's about the right frequency seen from RPS. Okay. I want to sort of blast through this because I want to get you to the second half of my talk. But if you want, it's a slightly complicated effect. It's known as the Knudsen effect. I actually didn't know about it until this experiment. But here's for those of you that haven't heard of it, this is what happens. If you imagine applying the field parallel to the planes, so this is the two surfaces, for example, and now I'm applying a magnetic field in this direction. What you expect to happen at low fields is that your cyclotron orbits will always bounce off the interface, right? This actually gives you an extra contribution to the resistance. Then, once you get to high fields, your cyclotron orbits become smaller than the thickness of the sample, and fewer of them bounce off the interface. And the consequence is that you see this kind of effect. You see a rise in the magnetoresistance at low fields, and then at this Knudsen point, when the cyclotron radius drops below the thickness of the sample, the magnetoresistance actually decreases, and then eventually it goes metallic again. So this is why this is important. This point here, for the different samples that we measured in our, whose thickness we measured in the fib, this point and field here gives you an independent measure of what the thickness of the sample actually is. Okay? And the reason why this is exciting is because we started to see quantum oscillations only for samples that dropped below the thickness of the mean free path of the bulk. Okay, and we could see that directly in the data. Yeah.
Why wasn't it bigger for the 150 nanometers one than the 500? Where is it largest of this 500, the intermediate one?
Well, that's a combination. I mean, to answer that question, you have to understand the microscopics of what the scattering mechanism is at the interface. And I wouldn't actually, I mean, this is offset data, by the way. So you have to understand what the bulk magnetoresistance should look like, as well as what these interface effects should look like. And what you're seeing is the sum of those two things. So I don't have a clear. A short answer is I don't know, but the longer answer is there is no really clear way to say anything important about the actual shape of this hump. Just its position, it's important for now that we understand. Recall that for our quasi-particle orbit, there are two type scales involved. The important one is, of course, that it involves the traversal of the bulk at a certain velocity going through that bulk. So when you see the quantum when you measure the quantum oscillation amplitude from the surface state, you can plot that, let's say, normalized to the bulk state, which you assume is a constant in the system, and then see how it grows as a function of thickness. Okay. So for the very thick devices, you get a very small amplitude of the surface state relative to the bulk state, and it grows essentially exponentially with the thickness or the thinness of the sample. And what's the coefficient in the exponential? It's approximately half the mean free path. Why is it half the mean free path? Because to make a complete quasi-particle orbit, you have to go once through here and once through here in the bulk. Right? So in other words, twice this guy should be the mean free path, which is approximately right, as you can see. I've contrasted this against a 1 over L dependence, which is what you would expect for a trivial surface state. And this has obviously been an issue with our referees. But we think that this data is much better fitted by a exponential dependence. But you can see, and I agree, that maybe it's not clear. Maybe you could also fit the same kind of data to a 1 over L dependence, which would be associated with trivial. But here, the reason why you get exponential is exactly the same reason why you get dampening from scattering in trivial surface states. Just to brush over, the point is that during a scattering event, any scattering event in a quasi-particle orbit, your suppression of your quantum oscillatory amplitude goes exponentially with the probability that you're actually going to make one of those full quasi-particle orbits. And that's characterized by omega c tau, right? The cyclic frequency multiplied by the scattering time. Here, our effective omega c tau involves the length of the sample, right? So that exponential dampening factor in your quantum oscillations, which is known for trivial metals, now has to go into the suppression of your Weyl orbits. And that's why we think it's exponentially activated like this as a function of the thickness of the sample. Okay. But again, all of this is in some sense circumstantial. It's about right, but not really an acid test. So we thought we'd come up with a different way to do this. So recall that the phase of the oscillations depends on the thickness of the sample. Well, it turns out that in order to do a systematic phase relationship, you need about a nanometer in stepping each of these devices, and that's a little bit beyond our resolution to really see this phase change. But we thought of a different way of doing it. And the way we thought we could distinguish is by having two devices fabricated under exactly the same conditions, grazing incidents, same sample, same orientation, all of that. But one of them would have two parallel faces and the other one would be a triangular face. Why is this important? Because here, the thickness, the two parallel faces, the thickness is the same, which means the phase is the same for all the oscillations. Here, the phase varies continuously along all phases, which means that all of your quantum oscillations destructively interfere, so you expect no quantum oscillations from this triangular device if it was a Weyl orbit, but you expect quantum oscillations from this parallel device. And note, you would never expect this for a trivial system, right? A surface state is a surface state. And it doesn't matter that what the shape of the sample is, you should still see the quantum oscillation. And this is what we observe. The red is the triangular device, see the bulk frequency, no evidence of the surface state frequency. The blue is the parallel device, you see both again. So we thought this was pretty clear evidence that something that was sensitive to the shape of the bulk was going on. And so even if it's maybe not exactly as Drew had thought, had cooked up this Weyl cyclotron orbit, it's something very similar to that. So qualitatively it seemed consistent. There was one other thing that we saw that we couldn't understand completely. And I think it was you, Joseph, that was asking me about whether you can get tunneling effectively, like premature tunneling from the surface state to the bulk. And it turns out you can. And that gives you a contribution to your oscillatory phenomena that puts your oscillations slightly out of phase. So when you measure quantum oscillations, they're not exactly periodic in 1 over b. But actually the phase changes very slowly as a function of the Landau index, which is n, how high in field you are. So we saw this downward curvature and we didn't fully understand it. Somehow Drew had already thought about this idea. I guess maybe it's obvious to theorists. Oh, wait a sec. You do see this kind of thing in, say, topological surface states. So in the case of TIs, the fact that you've broken time reversal symmetry creates a gap at the Dirac node, and so that gap actually changes the phase of your oscillations. And I saw this back on TIs back in 2010. But it doesn't make sense for this state. For one, the direction is wrong. Note that these actually go away from and bend downward away from the Landau index. But our ones always point towards, so they had the wrong curvature. In addition, this is actually, for the topological surface states, you need to include a very large G factor to get this effect, because that determines the splitting of your surface states. To get the G factor to answer this data, you need a G factor of 300. It's more than 10 times what's actually measured in the material. But if we looked at Drew's paper and understand this is what he called the non-adiabatic contributions, so where you have essentially tunneling from the surface state into the bulk prematurely, we could get we could match the numbers with his idea, and it depended essentially on this ratio plus this factor, this prefactor alpha, which could be determined phenomenologically. He said that prefactor should be of order 1. What we get to explain all of our data is 1.2. So we think that this effect, this non-adiabatic contribution, this change of phase, can't be answered through other mechanisms like G factor splitting or whatever, but it can be answered by what's expected by this tunneling effect. Okay. Let me just skip this, and just let me take you to part three, because I'm excited about this. It's only a few slides. Sorry, this, I guess in some sense, a really exhausting talk. But I'm going to change gears. And here, what I'm going to try and tell you about is the most recent project that we are involved in, which I think could be a potential way to distinguish trivial from topological systems in a very clear way. So we're pretty excited about this. Okay. So an ordinary Landau quantization, if you think how the chemical potential actually varies as a function of magnetic field, it always increases. This is why it's called Landau diamagnetism. So if you look at the magnetization, it's negative the derivative, so it's negative, which is the diamagnetic contribution. Okay? So Landau diamagnetism, you always expect the magnetization to be diamagnetic. But think of a topological system or a Dirac system. Okay? The reason why I call it topological is because the Berry phase goes into the Landau quantization. This is what gives you this last Landau level, the n equals 0 Landau level, which doesn't change in energy. Everyone understands this. You see it in graphene, you see it in TIs, and so on. But this has a very important consequence if you think about the total magnetization contribution from a Dirac state. If you increase the field, the total energy actually will start to decrease, right? Because the degeneracy of this n equals 0 Landau level still increases, and all your electrons are just falling into that one. So the net total energy is decreasing. So the contribution from a Dirac system is actually paramagnetic, right? Okay, how would you distinguish this? Well, we think you can distinguish it if you can get to a magnetic field where you're at the quantum limit, namely at the last Landau level. And there you can really see the difference in the Berry phase of these materials. For a trivial state, your quantization goes as n plus a half. For a Dirac state, it's square root. But the point is that the n doesn't have a phase factor due to the cancellation of including the Berry phase. And then when you look at the magnetization of the quantum limit, a trivial state will always be diamagnetic, but it will go towards some constant in field. But a Dirac state, the magnetization contribution from a Dirac state will always vanish in the quantum limit. So far, nothing very exciting, very interesting. And the total magnetization that you would expect would be the combination of the two. But here's the important part. At the quantum limit, where your Dirac state stops contributing its paramagnetic contribution, it'll stop contributing that at the quantum limit completely. So you should see an anomaly in the magnetization at the quantum limit due to the existence of a Dirac Fermi surface. Okay. We measured torque, which is essentially a measure of the magnetic anisotropy. You apply a magnetic field, and the difference between the magnetization and the sample, or the direction of the magnetization, the sample, and the field gives you a net torque. And in theory, this is the kind of thing that you should see. All right. This is both theory plots. So for a trivial state, or massive electrons, you see quantum oscillations, as you normally would. And then as you go towards the quantum limit, you just have one contribution to the total magnetization. And it's the same sign as what it is in the low field state. It always remains positive. In other words, it's diamagnetic in our notation. But think of Weyl electrons. Well, Weyl electrons are different. And remember, you have contributions from both trivial and Weyl. But the rest of your band structure also has a diamagnetic effect. But if in the low field you're dominated by Weyl systems, your total torque will actually be negative, right? But then as you reach the quantum limit, then you only see the diamagnetic trivial contribution. So your torque changes sign. And this is what the data looks like. The torque has a net negative contribution in all the low fields. But then as it crosses the quantum limit what's thought to be the Dirac state, you have this change of sign. If they were always trivial electrons, you would never have the change of sign, because you'd always have a Landau diamagnetic contribution. It's the fact that you've got a linear combination of diamagnetic and paramagnetic that gives you this change of sign, because the paramagnetic contribution goes to zero at the quantum limit. That's the important point. So this is a test of whether a system is topological or not, Dirac or not, to be technically correct. Yeah?
There has to be the spin has to couple the momentum linearly. Yeah, you just have like a sigma dot k term.
I mean, the point is actually this. You just need, I mean, yes, but you need this n equals 0 lambda level. And the reason why you get this n equals 0 lambda level is exactly because of the Berry phase, because the Berry phase is 0, which gives you a 0, you know, a 0 point energy that's 0. Yeah?
So then I question, you know, torque is a vector, pseudo vector. How do you define its sign?
Okay, so that's a good question. In order, that's right. So we don't necessarily know whether it's completely diamagnetic or paramagnetic in the low field state just from the absolute value of the torque. But the point is really that it changes sign. That's the important point. So you would never see this in a trivial system. But you're right. I mean, if it turned out that there's just very few other ways of doing this unless the system is magnetic. You're right, though, that in principle this part could be diamagnetic and then this part was paramagnetic, but I don't know of many things that could actually do that with such a big change, whereas you would always expect the change of sign in a topological system. So if you had some other way of determining the total magnetic moment, so actually measure the magnetization, you could see that it was, and we're doing this experiment now, where you can see the magnetization is negative on one side and positive on the other. But the torque just tells us that there is a big change of sign. And the reason why we use it is because this is a very easy thing to do, and also it's an extremely sensitive probe. So the reason, the fact that it's easy is actually very important. Not everybody has angle-resolved photoemission in their lab, right? What's more, angle-resolved photoemission only really tells you what the electronic dispersion looks like. We think this probe, and pretty much everybody has a cryostat and a magnet in their lab, you can actually use this to experimentally decide whether a system is topological or not, as long as you can take it to the quantum limit, of course. This would always, to us, this would always seem to appear as a as an important contribution. Yeah?
So if you start to dope this, so let's say, what, is this still
active? Yeah, the quantum limit would go down. That's right.
But if you still see the sign change.
Absolutely. Okay, another important point about this. So recall at the very beginning I told you there are three different kinds of systems, Weyl and 3D Dirac. Well, you can actually use this probe to distinguish between these kinds of systems as well. Not just that it's topological or not, but also whether it's Weyl or Dirac. Because in a Weyl system, if you change the angle of the field with respect to the Weyl points, you won't break the degeneracy of these points, right? For a 3D Dirac system, along one angle, you won't break the degeneracy of the points, but if you rotate the field, you'll actually break time-reversal symmetry, and you'll actually break the symmetry that protected their degeneracy, and as a result, they'll interfere and actually split the Dirac points. And that will come up in your quantum oscillation frequency itself. So in other words, you can use this probe...
It becomes effectively violent, huh?
No. Here, it would become effectively trivial. It's like this adds a massive term. Yeah. So if you prefer to see band structure, the point is that along any angle, you will always preserve the Dirac degeneracy, the Weyl degeneracy for a purely Weyl system. But for a 3D Dirac system, along one direction, you might be able to shift the Weyl point by applying magnetic field. But along the other direction, you actually create a splitting in the Dirac spectrum. So this becomes like not just a way to distinguish trivial from non-trivial, topologically non-trivial systems, but also a way to do it to distinguish Weyl from 3D Dirac. So we think this is an exciting way to experimentally make a search for topological systems without appealing to DFT first, I guess. Okay, so just to bring you to my conclusions, we've managed to fabricate these systems as thin films to get to the Fermi arc surface states. We had a very nice idea of Phillips to actually fabricate a parallel and triangular device to distinguish between them from trivial states. And we've seen these beautiful quantum oscillations on all these devices, which we think are qualitatively consistent with the Weyl orbit scenario. And then finally, we think we found an interesting and new way, although in principle, I guess everybody should have known this, of distinguishing between trivial, Weyl, and Dirac systems by just looking at the sign change in torque magnetometry. So let me thank the important people again, Philip Roning and Eric Bauer for providing the latter samples of the niobium arsenide. And then again, to point out Drew Potter and Philip Moll. And with that, I'd like to thank you.
Thanks, James. Beautiful talk.
Can you estimate for realistic materials what would be this size of magnetic field where the torque is changing sign? I mean,
So it depends entirely on what the quantum limit is. So the lower the doping, the lower the magnetic field that you would see the sign change. So in our case, we worked on niobium arsenide, and the Fermi energy there is about 30 tesla. That corresponds to the area of the orbit. So it means that above 30 tesla, you would see the torque anomaly. So in our case, it was about 45. But if you had a system that was much closer to the Dirac point, you would see it in much lower fields. But it's a very good point. Like, if you have a high doping Dirac system, then not everybody has 40 tesla in the lab. So I might have exaggerated there about its accessibility. What's that?
This is from high magnetic field and in the data.
That's right, yeah. We had this was all 40 tesla data. Actually 60 to really nail it. Here you need to go to Los Alamos. Here you need to go to Tallahassee. Here you can come to my lab.
The way that you fabricate these samples, is it fair to assume that tau B is actually independent of sample thickness?
So yes, because you can calculate the penetration depth of the gallium using an analysis program designed for this. And you can see in the geometry that we're using that the penetration depth and the thickness is actually very small. So within a nanometer for this geometry, for the grazing geometry.
So does this argument only hold in 3D, or can you also do that in 2D? For graphene, for example, what do you expect?
So it should of course work for 2D. But the beauty of 3D is that you have a bigger signal because you have a bigger contribution from the bulk.
So it would be hard to do in 2D to see this.
It would be hard to do in 2D. So this is a great question. Okay, so let's say I was Luli and I wanted to know whether samarium hexaboride was topological or not. But the topological part is actually only the surface state, which has a small contribution. However, he does use torque magnetometry to actually measure his quantum oscillations, so they do have a signal. The thing is, it would be a small contribution on top of the total background of the bulk. So instead of seeing a change in sign, you would start from some high level, and then you would see a kink. So you would always still see an anomaly, but it wouldn't always be manifested as a change of sign. The fact that we have a bulk system, so there's a very large contribution from Weyl electrons and a similar contribution from bulk electrons, trivial electrons, you can actually see a change of sign.
But in graphene, for example, you should see a change of sign.
In graphene, you should see a change of sign. Yeah.
What's on trivial in graphene?
Well, I think he's saying because you've got the n equals zero Landau level.
But you have direct cones, but it's not topological.
Yes,
I think your technique tells you that you have gapless Dirac cones.
Gapless Dirac cones.
Not that it's necessarily topologically not.
Well, okay, but it tells you you've got an n equals zero Landau level that doesn't change with field, right?
The graphene has.
Oh, okay. I'm not too familiar with what happens in graphene, so.
Okay, there's also many body effects, but that's another issue.
Okay, yeah. So what happens in graphene in high field? I'm not sure. Do you know?
I mean, there is a zero quantum level, but then it splits, right? I think it's.
I mean, yeah.
Well, yeah, I mean, n equals zero Landau level, so spin and valley degeneracies, and those could spontaneously polarize, so it could split into, in principle, to four Landau.
Oh, yeah, that's right. You have this polarization issue, right, yeah. So, yeah, it's a good question.
So those energies could be field dependent, basically.
Yeah.
So why did you say...
Also, it's like a single layer, so I'm not sure how you could actually do this experiment, because if it's a single monolayer, I would have thought so, yeah, like to put a flake on top. Oh, it's an interesting idea. I mean, Dan Ralph does a lot of these kinds of experiments, so maybe it's possible.
Why do you say samarium hexaboride or another topological insulator is that there would be a big bulk contribution? I mean, if the bulk is insulating, it's truly insulating.
This is no itinerant electron. Yeah. So the problem. I mean, you would still have a contribution from the bulk. It might be small. The other problem with samarium hexaborate is that it's potentially magnetic, right? Because it also has samarium in it. So I think you might also have to worry about the magnetism of the of these, you know, rare earth elements. Okay. So that would be my only hesitation. But yes, I mean, in principle, maybe you could see it. It just depends which one is the larger of the contribution, whether it's the itinerant electrons, the pool, you know, the Pauli contribution, or whether it's some other magnetic effect inside the system.
I don't see any further questions. Let's thank James.